Good afternoon, and welcome to Born on the 4th of July on RBN. It's a pleasure to be your host for the next 2 hours, and I would recommend that you call and notify your friend and neighbor and say, please listen in to Born on the 4th of July. This morning, it was my opportunity, as it has been this past couple of weeks, to go water a family member's beautiful garden as they have been in the hospital. It's been a little bit chaotic, but seriously, I have enjoyed those moments in that beautiful garden early in the morning all to myself. And it's hard for me when there not to say life and the garden is truly beautiful. And yet, as I drive to my spot to water, I think of the darkening thoughts that people are trying to understand and the need to know, the essential need to know. Today, ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to introduce my friend, a true investigative reporter, and someone with whom I have had contact during interviews for years, for quite a while, and had the opportunity to meet and also meet his family in the year 2006. Christopher Boleyn, far and wide and international investigative reporter, welcome to Born on the 4th of July. Right here on RBN, we have a quick break in about 2 or 3 minutes, and then we have the regular extended hour to go, and we hope you'll be with us 2 hours. Welcome to Born on the 4th of July.
Thank you.
It's a new spot here for me, you know. It used to always be K-Talk.
Yeah, but you're on Republic Broadcasting. That's very good, and I suppose you're listened to by many, many people. It's a great honor. It's a great pleasure to be with on the air with you.
Well, we hope you're having a good experience, and in looking at your website and those very, very in-depth stories and news reports, plus the pictures, you're doing a great job for the world.
Well, thanks. You know, I really am glad to talk to you because we have so much in common, and so much has been done in Utah about 9/11. You know, I came out there, I spoke out there, and I've had a lot of supporters in Utah. And, of course, Professor Jones and the discovery of super thermite in the dust. This is really the icing on the cake for 9/11 truth seekers.
I spoke with him this morning before going on the air here. He sends you his greetings. He has a birthday for his father today, but he appreciates what you have done.
Oh, that's great. You know, I'm so glad to hear from him. He was a supporter of mine when I was in trouble with the when I had the police incident at my house when the undercover police came and attacked me. He wrote on my behalf, and it's interesting that, you know, he and I both we had a lot of difficulties with we've had a lot of suffering, and we've paid a big price, and I'm sure that it's because his thermite research and the work we were doing in 2005 and 2006, and his evidence of thermite was such
a hot subject.
We'll
go to break here, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Welcome back to Born on the 4th of July. We have Christopher Boleyn, whose work taught me so many things. A molten steel, we talked about that at first, an appeal to scientists that he made early on in 9/11, activity at thereafter, and extraordinary rendition. I could just go down a very long list. So for you, the listener, in case this is the first time you've heard from him, this is a wonderful opportunity. I guess we have a new administration now, and you might want to talk to us a little bit about that. I understand you're from Chicago, and so is he. Mm-hmm. Also, we have Arlen Specter giving an extraordinary gift to this new administration. Mm-hmm. So, take us where you'd like us to go.
Sure. First, I'd like to say about the Jones discovery of thermite, super thermite in the dust. This is, as Neil Tarit said, the final nail in the coffin of the 9/11 cover-up. I think that a lot of people and listeners may not understand how important this discovery is or how significant, because maybe they haven't read the full 25 pages. It's really not very difficult reading. It's Professor Jones has written it for the layman, but what it is that it's solid evidence that this very highly energetic nanotechnology explosive was found in five dust samples, all the dust samples that they tested from the remains of the pulverized World Trade Center towers. And this is crucial because this means that the fire collapse scenario, the official story, everything that we've been told about what caused those collapses of those towers does not take into account the fact that those buildings were lined with a very highly energetic, very thin layer of a nanotechnology, a nanocomposite superthermite. I mean, this is it. And as Americans and as citizens of the world, we have to take action with this. We have to take this material, take this evidence, take the time to read the paper so we understand it, but then we have to take it to the media, our local media, and we have to take it to our politicians and our elected leaders and even our local police and our local officials to tell them that this shows that we've been given a pack of lies about 9-1-1. And we have to, we still live in a representative democracy, at least, we hope so. And I don't agree with people who think that we should just take our guns and hunker down and wait for Armageddon and give it up on the media. I think that the media, we have to call the media to account. There certainly are a lot of media outlets in the United States which are not completely controlled, which are open to the truth, and which are responsive to the needs and the demands of the citizens. So we have to do something about it. And that's why on my website, it's www.bollyn, B as in boy, OLLYN.com. I issued, after I read the paper, as soon as I got it, I read it several times, and I issued a citizen action plan and calling for people to do exactly that, to take this material, to take this evidence, and to present it to the media and present it to their elected officials in Congress and locally and demand they confront this evidence and address it, because that's what we have to do. The democracy, what we have in America, is not a spectator sport. It's not a something that you just consume once every 4 years in an election. It's a participatory sport. It's something that we have to all participate in, and we have to be engaged in it, the people in Switzerland and in Europe. I mean, look at how can it be that people in Thailand can mobilize themselves in huge numbers and bring down the government, not just once, but twice in a matter of a month. First the orange shirts or the yellow shirts and the red shirts. And all across Europe, it's common that people take mass action. And I really do hope that Americans, understand the importance of Professor Jones' research and the discovery of superthermite and take it to the media and take it to their officials. Write letters to the White House. Write letters to your congressman, to your senator. Because the accusation or the charge that we're conspiracy theorists is now, it's history. We're not the conspiracy theorists. Osama bin Laden is not the party who put this superthermite in the World Trade Center. And so we have to find out who did.
Indeed. And, it was interesting in watching Dr. Niels Harrit, who is part of this paper, the active thermitic material discovered in the dust from 9/11 World Trade Center catastrophe, the name of that paper, hitting the world about April 2009, an extraordinary event, as you say. He says that hundreds of thousands of people around the globe know that it was demolition. They're already accepting of that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the phrase smoking gun, it was corrected to mean the loaded gun. They mm-hmm. have the evidence.
Exactly. And as you said, I didn't understand for a while, but they have found in each one of these things, people don't understand what nanotechnology means, but this is when the components, the thermite components, aluminum and ferrous oxide, when at least one of them is smaller than one-tenth of a micron, nano size. In this case, both were very, 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 very small. And that means they're mixed in a very, very, very fine solution. And it, what it appears, the thinness of the solution makes it appear that this was like a coating that had been sprayed inside of the towers, you know, maybe under the floor pans and on the walls and you know, all around. And, you know, I contacted somebody who was Burton Fried, a man from a demolition company, who a magazine called Engineering News and Report on September 13, 2001, he said that he had done extensive asbestos abatement work in the towers. And I was very intrigued by this, and so I called him up, and he said, no, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. It was a company called AASI, but they've gone out of business. Well, you know, I've tried to reach Mr. Fried since then. I'd like to ask him again about that, and I've written to him if he's read this paper, because his company is a company that worked very closely with Controlled Demolition Incorporated on large demolition projects. His company would go in and apply the pre-weakening, do the pre-weakening of the structure, and then CDI from Baltimore would go in and place the charges. And, you know, somebody had access to the World Trade Center, and somebody was in there spraying this stuff all over the place. And it's really not that hard to find out. We if we get people involved and people who work in the World Trade Center can say, yeah, I remember there was this team that was in there every day for like months spraying this stuff around, you know, and that's probably what it was. These companies hire usually people from South America and Latin America who don't have visas and things. Like, for example, Mr. Burton Fried's company called LVI, they've been charged many times with hiring, you know, immigrants and paying them, you know, really bad wages and putting them in really bad working conditions. So these people may have been put in there and just told to spray this stuff, you know, all over here and here and here, and don't smoke while you're in here, and then and spray the whole wall. And something like that happened because the very thin layer of thermite that's been found, Professor Jones even at one point thought, well, at first thought, maybe this is paint, but it's too thin to be paint. And it's clearly not paint. You know, you wouldn't make a paint that's made out of super thermite. And as we know, when these little tiny red chips were heated to 430 degrees Celsius, they created a huge exothermic reaction, and it basically exploded. And this is the explanation, to my mind, this is the best explanation thus far for the incredible pulverization of the concrete and the mass of the World Trade Center. You know, people don't understand, but the World Trade Center didn't come crashing down and fall on the ground. It was pulverized, and it became these huge clouds of powder, of dust that enveloped all of lower Manhattan. And that's what happened. You know, when they talk about the seismic shock waves that we saw, this is when I first discovered the molten metal in the World Trade Center, was in 2002 in the summer. The seismic shock waves, we see a tremendous seismic shock wave, like a spike, at the very beginning of the collapse. And it's not the shock wave of something hitting the ground, because if you look at the videos, you see that really nothing hit the ground. Something did, but not nearly. Most of the mass of the building, of the concrete, was just turned into dust. And the only way you can explain that is if you have this highly energetic explosive covering great, great amounts of the concrete in the building. And that's what Professor Jones has found. And I think that for Professor Jones and for me, it validates what we've been saying for years. And it's like, for me, it's like the hump. We've crossed the hump. And so now I say the game is over. The 9/11 cover-up game is over. All we have to do now is find the details. Who put it in there? Who hired them to put it in there? And et cetera, et cetera. But this is why I'm now preparing my book. I'm writing my book. I'm not writing it. The book's all written, basically. It's hundreds and hundreds of articles and chapters that I'm now putting together, and it's called Solving 911, an Independent Investigation of the Crime of the Century. And what Niels Harry wrote to me when I spoke to him in April is he said something very, very interesting. He said, this is a collective effort. And that's what it is. This is a collective effort, you know. Professor Jones and I are not becoming wealthy from looking for the truth of 911. On the contrary, we both pay very high prices. You know, I've been run out of my hometown. I've lost my home, you know, and things like that. Professor Jones has also lost his teaching career and you know, had a great deal of financial burdens put upon him. And, of course, we've had all kinds of slanders and charges laid against us of being this and that. But this is it. This is the icing on the cake. And so I want to get my book finished this spring. It's going to, I want to get it published. And a publisher in Asia, in Korea, is very interested. And he told me, you know, send me the table of contents. And I didn't realize that's the hardest part. That's the best, the biggest part of writing the book.
Well, you're prepared, though. Here comes the music. It is an exciting day. America should now stand tall with the work that is now presented that we're just discussing. So let's hope it's going to be a better day with this information. It surely should be. Returning to today's guest, Christopher Boleyn, you were discussing a table of contents and a possible publisher when we went to break. So if you'd like to pick it up there, and then I'd like to return just with a couple of comments back to December 2001.
Sure. The thing is that what I'm putting together is, you know, one of my websites has been hijacked. Boleyn.info has been hijacked. And the thing is that websites are, of course, by their very nature, are ethereal. They're temporary. They're like radio waves. They're, you know, they're one day they're there and one day they're not. You know, I learned that very, very quickly that my entire website and all my websites could be just taken away in a heartbeat. And so, of course, 911, my degree is in history, and I want to make my contribution, my research, more available to the public, because, you see, the thing is that, you know, there's so many articles there. I've written, you know, hundreds of articles about 9/11, and you really have to read them in some sort of chronological order, and also in certain sections to understand, you know, where we've gotten, how we've gotten to where we are today, and how I've come to the conclusions that I've come to about the perpetrators of 9/11 and who did it, and the war on terror, and all of this hoax that America has been suffering under for the last 7 years. And 8 years, and I've written about this for 7.5 years, just about 9/11. And you know, I want to make my research permanent. I want to put it down in a book form so that people have access to it years from now. That it's out there, that it's printed, and it's available to the public, because it is in fact my history, my historiography of the research of 9/11. And it's you know, it's quite different from what they're going to read in newspapers or in other places. And, you know, my thesis has been validated a great, great deal by Professor Jones' discovery and by other things that have happened. So now is the time for me to finish it. But as I say, this is a collective effort. And I have a publisher. There's a publisher in Europe that's interested in their languages. There's a publisher in Korea who's interested in his language. But for the English-speaking book, I don't have a publisher yet, and I may very well self-publish. But I really could use some support, because it's a expensive process to self-publish. And I was thinking that I would publish maybe 1,000 or 2,000 books, in June or so, and then see how that goes. But you know, the thing is that the book is not going to make money. These books don't make money. And, it's important that my research be made available to the public in a form that they can easily read and pick up and understand, rather than one article here, one article there, you know, here and there. As I said, you know, some of my articles are now deleted.
When you first approached the topic of the 9/11 event, and wasn't it true that you did go and get right there to Ground Zero at some of your time frame and in your investigation? When I mentioned returning to 2001, you were already speaking internationally with a lot of different people, and I can remember one interview that we did that you referred to Andreas von Bülow, but in looking at some of your work, as early as December 2001, you spoke with Eckhart Werthenbach, and these folks had a definite idea about what might have happened early on, did they not?
Oh, absolutely. These were the German intelligence professionals. There were three of them I spoke to, and that was in December. Let me go back on that question. We were in, we happened to have been in passing by the Manhattan early in the morning. We were driving the car. We were passing through Manhattan on September 11th at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And as we did so, my wife was telling me this dream about these airplanes attacking us. I discussed this in detail in the first chapter of my book. It's called 9/11 through the eyes of an American skeptic. And that's a big article I wrote for a Swiss magazine, and that's going to be the first chapter of the book. But then, yes, and we stayed in America. I was doing a lot of research, and my first article on 9/11 was written just several days after 9/11, and it was the article about the five dancing Israelis that we've heard so much about, these who turned out to be intelligence operatives with the Mossad, who were, you know, videotaping the burning towers in the background in New Jersey, and they were in Liberty Park, and they were flicking their lighters and like smiling and giving high fives as the World Trade Center was collapsing. And this was, you know, seen by some people, and these men were eventually arrested. And they went back to Israel, and they said, you know, people have to understand that Israel suffers terrorism all the time. Our purpose was to document the event. And these guys worked for this little fake Israeli moving company that, you know, was the owner fled Israel the next week. And, you know, it's all part of the Israeli involvement in 9/11. And when I was writing about this, this was one of the first articles I wrote, I realized that, you know, if these people are so cold-blooded that they can kill 3,000 people in broad daylight, and here I come waltzing in, you know, I'm raining on their parade and saying that, no, it's not like that. You know, what about this and what about that? That my life would be in danger. So in November, after Thanksgiving of 2001, we went to Europe. My wife is from Europe. We went to Europe, and that's when I got in touch with these guys from the German intelligence, and they all said, Andreas von Bülow and Werner Eckhardt, I can't remember his name, Vertebach.
That's he told Vertebach. Me that, yeah.
They told me that there was no question that this was a state-sponsored intelligence agency operation.
We're going to go to break
operation.
Here. We'll go to the music, and
okay.
We'll be right back. Returning to Born on the 4th of July, we were talking about some of the comments you found early on. Eckhardt Rissenbach, I'll say, he was former head of domestic branch of German intel, and a couple of his comments: the deadly precision and magnitude of planning behind the attacks would have required years of planning and require the fixed frame of state intel organization, something not found in a loose group such as Al-Qaeda or ATA, whatever. Andreas von Bülow, the overseer of German intel agencies, told you personally that sophisticated false flag of 9/11 had the structure of three levels: architectural, operational, and working. I just bring that backdrop up so you can see how long Mr. Berlin has been working on the issue, and what a day it must be to have the findings of this new panel of scientists, April 2009. Don't forget that. Now, I'm aware we have callers coming on the air, and will you take calls, Mr. Berlin?
Sure.
All right. We have David in California. I want to thank you for waiting. And then in the lineup, we have Leon, also from California. David, you're on for your question or comment, and welcome.
Hey, greetings, Barbara Jean and Christopher. You know, one of the first things I'd ask, I heard you mention that you were hacked on your existing site, or whether they took over your site address. Do you have a replacement site now, or do you have can you find it under cache?
Yeah. Well, no. The site which was hijacked is Bolin.info, and it was set up in Estonia. I set it up in 2007, and the person that we hired, this Estonian fellow who we hired to set up the website, went ahead and has effectively hijacked it, you know, re-registered it. It's still in my name, but I'm working with GoDaddy to try and get it back. It's very easy in a small country like that for the intelligence to influence somebody and say, you know, now we want you to shut down Mr. Bolin's website. And but Bolin.com, www.bolin.com, is still up. It's working much better. My wife's been working very hard and getting that fixed, and we have a competent webmaster. But we're struggling to get Bolin.info back. I hope I can.
Okay, good. Yeah, then the other thing, I've been involved in this pretty much since the beginning, and I keep giving the advice that we just need to keep making sure that there are plateaus, that we gain these certain informational standards and then make sure that they're out there in the public. So I think, you know, the recognition, for example, that World Trade Center 7, there's something enormously wrong with it. Now, you know, making sure that the thermite is brought into the standard with this, the general public will much more get involved in this when once there are a number of different standards that cannot be lowered beneath. So I'm just wondering, for example, out here in California, just before 9/11 happened, California was being eaten alive with Enron, and the dropping of World Trade Center 7, Enron documents, the Federal Trade Commission was in World Trade Center 7. It was very important for these organized crime people to destroy the evidence. And one of these new plateaus that I think we should really be leaning on is the other agencies within World Trade Center 7 and the amount of evidence that the New York office of the FBI, the New York office of the CIA, the New York office of the Federal Trade Commission were in Building 7. When that building fell, that was an enormous amount of evidence that was destroyed.
But, David, and, you know, it goes even further than that. I filed an FOIA to find out what companies had worked inside the World Trade Center in the year prior to 9/11, and the standard answer you get after they respond to your FOIA is that they assume that all evidence, all documents pertaining to that were destroyed in the collapses. So, you know, they destroyed a lot of evidence when they destroyed those towers.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. The very day that the buildings fell, I went out of my way to go to the websites of the World Trade Center, and I got the lists of all of the occupants of it. So I think, you know, that stuff exists, you know, the occupants of all of the buildings. One other standard.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the people who worked. I'm talking about the kind of subcontractors who might have gone in there and done this spraying we were talking about. Subcontractors, outside people who came into the building who were doing maintenance work or asbestos abatement work or fireproofing, what have you. Those are the people I was looking for.
So the construction, and maintenance.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. Actually, that should be in existence in other in fact, this would get into one of the other plateaus. You know, of course, the neocons have always been talking about the free market should cover everything that exists. And so when you think about it, the insurance companies should be very involved in 9/11. If they have policies on these buildings, then they were responsible for paying out on them. And so you would think that they would be interested in documents related to potential fraud or criminal activity, which helped bring those down. So any insurance company on any of the different, say, for example, any of all of the tenants in all of the buildings, all of them had different insurance companies. So all of those different insurance companies hypothetically would have some claim against any kind of fraud involving those buildings. So,
yeah, well, mostly it was, you know, a couple of big companies that, for example, the building that insured, I think it was called Teachers, that insured building number 7, they paid out without even knowing, they paid out something like $400 million to Mr. Silverstein without even knowing what had caused the collapse.
Right.
You know, but there's a lot of back scratching going on here. There were the insurance companies, I believe, were supported by the Patriot Act. There was money flowing from the federal government to these insurance companies to help compensate them for their losses.
Right, and it doesn't even make sense that they would go out of their way to make payments unless there was some sort of a fix. You know, it's not even a good business model to just be handing out money in such a suspicious case. And so,
well, look at what the Obama administration and the Bush administration did with Mr. Greenberg. They gave billions and billions and billions of dollars to Maurice Greenberg, who's the first plane went into his office, into his computer room. Maurice Greenberg, he's the head of AIG, the biggest insurance company, right? And then the American government's paying hundreds of billions of dollars to this man who's running a criminal enterprise from A to Z. It's crazy.
A good clue might have been also, as we watched, with all of the money that the government paid to the families that were struck down with a loved one being part of the problem of not being able to get out or survive the 9/11 attack. I think there are about 90 or 96 families that decided they didn't want to take the government's money. And what kind of justice have they seen,
They've all been settled out of court. I think there's about three cases remaining. Last check, there were like three cases remaining. And these people are adamant that they want to have a trial. They want to have discovery. They want to have accountability. And the court of Alvin K. Hellerstein in Manhattan is very being very, very difficult about scheduling any trial for these people. It's been, you know, they've been waiting for 5 years now for their day in court, and they still haven't gotten it.
Right.
And if it goes on, it continues, if this war of attrition, I call it, goes on, even these three families may not be able to hold out much longer.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One other angle, and this was my first suspicion, you know, based upon the events of that day. I out here in California, I'm in San Francisco, very near Silicon Valley, and there was a headline in one of the business pages, and if I remember right, it was in either April or May of 2001, that the gold brokers in the basement of the World Trade Center were being busted for multiple selling the gold.
Mm-hmm.
During .com, you know, stock prices were just insane, and everybody realized that, you know, even though Yahoo had more share value than General Motors, there was mm-hmm. no logic to it. And all
right.
of these .com millionaires had paper
right.
money, but they wanted to get it into something real. So many of the
right.
shares of the .com companies, people had bought gold, and the gold brokers were multiple selling that gold. Well,
mm-hmm.
when Enron and the stock market swindle started getting exposed in early 2001, late 2000 and early 2001, the books of these gold brokers were starting to get exposed.
Right.
And so they were, it was a headline in the business pages out here, and if I remember right, it was the Examiner.
Mm-hmm.
Just before they did a transition, it was a full-size paper as opposed to the tabloid-sized paper they've got
mm-hmm.
now. And this article was talking about these gold brokers being exposed. It also made a side note that the International Monetary Fund had their gold stashed in these reserve vaults. They had essentially privatized the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
It was essentially the equivalent of Fort Knox, and to privatize Fort Knox would have been a huge scandal. But they
right.
had done it. They had privatized it, and then they were multiple selling the International Monetary's gold. So it would be as if Goldfinger had gone out of his way to multiple sell the gold in Fort Knox, and then when he started getting busted, he blew up Fort Knox to destroy the evidence. So I've always been looking at it from that angle, and I take the position that the reason why the Democrats are so silent about it is they've generally always supported the concept of the International Monetary Fund, and
mm-hmm.
for it to be looted in that way was a huge embarrassment to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, rather than getting into this, you know, war of words about whether or not the International Monetary Fund is a good or bad idea, it's
mm-hmm.
whether or not they were humiliated by the dropping or the looting of the gold reserves in there, because essentially after the dropping of the building, they just cleared the accounts. They credited all of the
mm-hmm.
nations of the world for the amount of loss of gold in there. And
but David,
so,
you're right. There's the thing is that behind 9/11 and all around 9/11 is of course this incredible plundering of the U.S. Treasury, and as you said, of the gold and things like that. And that is why I wrote quite a few articles recently at the end of the winter about the connection between the people involved in the huge financial bailout that the United States was giving to these private companies like AIG and 9/11. You know, the fact that Maurice Greenberg was indicted on something like 6 or 7 serious charges by Elliot Spitzer back
right.
in 2005, and then those charges were all basically washed away, and now Mr. Maurice Greenberg, I think, lives in Switzerland most of the time. But I mean, this man, Maurice Greenberg, is a central player in this entire crime. But what we have to work is, I mean, we have to work logically from the evidence. And when we work back, when we find out who blew up the buildings and who did this, who did the deed, then we will also find out why they did it and who's, you know, who's responsible. That's what we have to do at this point, I think. And then we'll understand all the crimes.
Sure, Thank you, David, for your good input, and keep watching. There's going to be lots more that will happen if, in fact, the populace at large becomes aware of this. You can't deny what we're talking about. And I also was told by Dr. Jones this morning that they are seeking to have a future paper in the near future. So we're going to go next to Leon in California. You're on with Christopher Boleyn. And
thanks
to David.
Thank you. Christopher, this is Leon. Me and you have corresponded. I'm one of your staunchest supporters. In fact, when Professor Stephen Jones was at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, I was out there with my friend Fatima, and we heard Stephen Jones's. I heard Stephen Jones's presentation on the thermite. And, you know, there was Jim Hoffman there, and the woman that had brought him the sampling of the powder. She had put a towel on her head for her and her husband. And I tell you, I've been following your stuff, and I think it's an honor to be listening to you, Christopher. You are one of my biggest heroes.
Thank you.
And I also, you know, I was talking to Richard Mack yesterday, who's an oath keeper, and he said that the sheriffs in America have more jurisdiction than the federal government. So if they want, they can go and arrest Silverstein and all these other bandits that have been screwing us up for a long time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But will they do it? You see, this is as I saw, I was in the county court. I was charged in the Cook County, which is Chicago, and I saw that the process was completely corrupt. In my case, it was a strong Zionist influence. The judge was a Zionist. The prosecutor was a Zionist. And the prosecutor said that they wanted to charge me because he said that my writings, I had written anti-Jewish writings and things like that. But, you know, this is the thing, is that you have behind this law enforcement, Leon, you have this secret societies in America. You know, if you drive in any American town, you see the whole marquee
what
full
of... That's what this guy told me. He told me, he said, when you call the police, and I told him all about you and your tasering and all this stuff, you know, when you call 911, he says they don't come to protect you, but later on they'll come to investigate.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
He says there's no way that you can rely. And he's been a cop for 20 odd years.
Yeah.
And he was so inspirational. So I told him to listen to this show, so maybe he'll call in.
Yes.
But I also want to know, you know, Eric Hofschmidt also is my good buddy. You call him Hushmik. But I think, you know, you guys should kind of get together. He is very intelligent, and I really respect both of you. That day,
Thank you very much.
At the UC Berkeley thing, when all they had finished, it was just a time for answering questions, nobody had mentioned Christopher Boleyn or Eric Hofschmidt. And I got up and I said, you know, what's with you people? You're doing... And then later on, when I went to talk with Stephen Jones, Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers was hogging the conversation with him. But Jones told me, he said, you know, I really respect Eric's work and give him my best regards.
Yeah.
So, Christopher, you know, we love you. You know, you're just dynamite. You're thermite.
You're thermite. He's nano. You're nano.
Yeah, he's nano thermite, dude. You're it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Leon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leon, for joining with us. We've got so much to cover, and our time's going to go so fast.
I just want to speak. Leon had a comment there. It's very difficult for me to make these radio shows actually right now. I have to, you know, arrange a connection and all that kind of thing because I don't personally have a phone. I personally don't even have a house. You know, I stay where I can and where I can afford to stay. That's why support is really needed now to get this book done because, you know, it's not something I can afford to do.
We hope the support and the plea for support will go out far and wide this day. We'll pick it up there when we come back, okay?
Okay.
and gentlemen, returning to Born on the 4th of July for the final segment. One of the things that Andreas von Bülow told Christopher early on, 95% of the work of intel agencies around the world is deception and disinformation propagated by mainstream media. This hour and the next, you are hearing vital information that is truth and researched. And if you would like to participate, how can they help you in your work, Christopher Boleyn?
Well, they could go to my website, www.boleyn.com, and they could send a, if by PayPal, they can send a donation to me through my to my email address. It's boleyn@boleynbooks.com. That's all on the internet. That's all on my website. And on the left side, it gives the address of my, you know, how to send if you want to write me a check or something. Because the thing is, it's very strange, you know, but Professor Jones, I met Professor Jones back in 2006 in March. I told him, Professor Jones, you have to be careful because there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, trying to trip us up. And I said, you know, I think you should stay here in Utah and Provo, you know, and stay with your Mormon church, and I think you're safer there. And it turned out he wasn't any safer in Utah than he was anywhere else. You know, we all know what happened to him, and you know, the church did not come to his defense. You know, they gave him a deal and this and that, but he was forced to retire. There never was a peer review. The Mormon church met with the elders of the church met with President Bush, and the next week Dr. Jones retired. But the thing is that the same thing is that the churches aren't helping us. The only people that are helping me are individual citizens here and there and yonder. I mean, I get donations from people in Canada, Australia. These are some of the biggest, the most active people, actually. New Zealand, you know, and America, all across. But the thing is that it comes from individual people. Individual people who realize that there's some value in my research and that they want to support it. But, you know, expecting help, you know, when I was attacked, I contacted all these journalist organizations. And you know, when this Iranian girl from North Dakota was held in jail in Iran, the president and Hillary Clinton got up on the pedestal and started talking about her, right? But when it happened in Chicago, when a journalist in Chicago was beaten by undercover police and tasered and hauled off to jail and charged as I was, nobody came to my help. My senator was Obama, by the way. And, you know, I wrote to him and I wrote to all my congressmen and all those people. And none of them came to my aid. None of those journalist organizations came to my aid. None of those human rights organizations came to my aid. Amnesty International, nobody, not even the Catholic Church could help me very much. I mean, I went to churches. I go to monasteries. Today I just realized it's only the few individual people here and there that are enabling me to do this research.
And yet they should realize that the tyranny that has been imposed since 9/11 affects them, their families, their future, their children to come, and the noose is being tightened as we speak.
We're living in, you know, Barbara Jean, we're living in a nightmare world for the last 8 years. I mean, I've been in this bizarre space the whole time because I knew it was a fake. I knew it was a hoax from the beginning. You know, that's been my field, these fake terror attacks and things. I've lived in Israel. I've seen how they do it, and they did the same thing in Israel. It caused a nightmare for the United States. It's brought us into all these bogus wars. It's caused the financial bailout, the same criminal.
We'll go to the top here for Christopher, and we'll be back after the music break.